If you won't fight back when they toxify your own body, when precisely will you fight back?
The FBI considers them the country's biggest domestic terrorist threat. They burn buildings. They burn SUVs. And now some of them want to go even further.
It's really cheapening the use of the term terrorism, and it's going to become at some point the government's going to be crying wolf, calling everything they don't like terrorism.
We have to stamp out civilization to save the planet?
The American author and activist Derek Jensen thinks so, and he offers his body to defeat the organized beast that is stripping the planet of forests, soil, and the species. There are three main reactions to the developing crisis here on Earth, whether you think of frightening climate change, raped ocean life, polluted slums, or just the economic unreality of the day. They are, let's fix it, let it fall, and finally the school of kick it over. Jensen is the prophet of slamming civilization, hoping it will fall before doing untold damage to nature. We'll hear from a recent speech, and we'll list some of the tenets of his belief, and add some books and web sources for further exploration. In The Sense of Balance, we'll also hear the FBI view and reactions to its latest green scare techniques to frighten environmental protesters. This is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. Personally, I don't agree with Derek Jensen. When it comes to taking out dams or cell phone towers by force, count me out. All that bravado just stimulates the beast to even more violence and oppression. Give me Gandhi, or give me death. Still, it isn't hard to find parts of Jensen's green despair in all of us.
So as a longtime grassroots environmental activist, and as a creature living in the thrashing endgame of civilization, I am intimately acquainted with the landscape of loss and have grown accustomed to carrying the daily weight of despair. I've walked clear cuts that wrap around mountains and drop into valleys and climb ridges to fragment watershed after watershed. And I've sat silent near empty streams that two generations ago were lashed into whiteness by uncountable salmon coming home to spawn and die.
Facing the extremes of extinction, including our own, we need to listen to every voice. In a sea of corporate propaganda, we need freedom of speech now more than ever.
They'll say, you know, if you really loved, you wouldn't want to fight. And I grew up in the country, and I have been attacked by mother horses, cows, hawks, eagles, spiders, mice, who thought I was attacking their babies. And if a mother mouse will take on someone 6,000 times her size, what the hell's wrong with us? You know, it's like, love does not imply pacifism. I don't think mother grizzly bears are going to agree with you on that one.
Saying he's been culture bashing for 15 years, Jensen defines civilization as a way of life characterized by the growth of cities. That is key now, as billions of humans are moving from rural land to polluted megacities all over the world. As delegates to the World Urban Forum in Vancouver in June 2006 were told, the fantastic growth of cities signals a mass internal migration never known to history for its size and its speed. We didn't plan for it, and we don't know the results of this huge human experiment. Cities, Jensen says, require the importation of resources, especially food grown from the land and the labor of others, and enforced with threats or acts of violence. Yet, Jared Diamond and historians generally warn us that no city or civilization has been sustainable. They are unstable structures which fall, often leaving a depleted soil and ecosystem. Of course, that doesn't mean dozens of generations didn't live well in them while they lasted.
I ask people all over the country, do you believe that our culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? And the answer is the same as at least a couple people in the front row with chuckles. Oftentimes people laugh out loud. It's absurd. And the next question is, if you don't believe that the culture is going to go and is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, what does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics? And the answer is we don't know. And one of the reasons we don't know is because we don't talk about it. And one of the reasons we don't talk about it is because we're all so busy pretending that we have hope.
We're catching Derek Jensen as a work in progress. In this clip, as author or co-author of at least 10 books, Jensen explains the progressive development of his last three works, namely, A Language Older Than Words, The Culture of Make-Believe, and now his two-volume series, Endgame.
It's like with A Language Older Than Words, I tried to show that the culture is really irredeemable from a psychological perspective. And we can go into that or not later, as the case may be. And with Culture Make-Believe, I tried to go into why the culture is irredeemable from sort of a social perspective, that as long as you have the social system of rewards that's in place, the system will lead inevitably to atrocity. And with the new book, I tried to sort of show how the culture is irredeemable on the level of physical movement of resources. Once again, we can all just have the most pure and wonderful hearts, and so long as you still need to get what's the stuff that's used for cell phones that is comes from Africa? Coltan, yeah. So long as cell phones require coltan, and so long as coltan comes in an area that is home to chimps, is it not, or is it? It's gorillas. Okay. Yeah, as long as it's home to gorillas, fuck them, you know? We need it. And end of story. And we can all, you know, we can all use our cell phones to talk about the latest green technologies. And it doesn't matter. So long as it requires coltan, the gorillas are screwed. So that's the first premise of the book, is this way of living is not and can never be sustainable. We can't just, you know, make a patch here too and make the thing work.
That comes from a speech given in March 2006 in Santa Cruz, California. It was part of a fundraiser for environmental activists charged with eco-terrorism, with penalties so severe they're intended to threaten all those who criticize polluting corporations and those who protest to save nature. The speech was recorded by Freak Radio and passed on to us by a popular alternative radio show called Unwelcome Guests. You can find that program and Derek Jensen's full speech at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, all.net. All right, let's get to the world according to Jensen. Here is a crude mashup of his major premises with just enough musical space between each to give you a moment to respond, inwardly. Get ready for a rapid-fire delivery of core beliefs which are startling, repulsive, and at times, just too true.
Okay, so the first premise of this book is that civilization is not and can never be sustainable. The second premise of the book is that traditional communities do not often voluntarily give up or sell the resources on which their communities are based until their communities have been destroyed. They also do not willingly allow their land bases to be damaged so that other resources, gold, oil, and so on, can be extracted. It follows that those who want the resources will do what they can to destroy traditional communities.
Those white men who've got the key to black men's identity in those lands, they're supposed to be forever.
The third premise. Our way of living is based on, requires, and will collapse very quickly without persistent and widespread violence.
What are we fighting for?
Okay, fourth premise of the book, and this is one of my favorite ones. This culture is based on a clearly defined and widely accepted, yet often unarticulated hierarchy. Violence done by those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is nearly always transparent, that is, unnoticed. When it is noticed, it's fully rationalized. Violence done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher is unthinkable. And when it does occur, is met with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims.
Social conditions, no one will openly visit. The atrocious revisions of our fathers' decisions that cast a shadow like a desert oak.
Okay, fifth premise of the book. The property of those higher on the hierarchy is more valuable than the lives of those below. It is acceptable for those above to increase the amount of property they control, in everyday language to make money, by destroying or taking the lives of those below. This is called production. If those below damage the property of those above, those above may kill or otherwise destroy the lives of those below. This is called justice. Okay, sixth premise of the book. This culture is not redeemable. The culture will not undergo any sort of voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living. If we don't put a halt to it, civilization will continue to immiserate the vast majority of humans and to degrade the planet until it, civilization, and probably the planet, collapses. The effects of this degradation will continue to harm humans and non-humans for a very long time. Seventh premise. The longer we wait for civilization to crash, or the longer we wait before we ourselves bring it down, the messier will be the crash, and the worse things will be for those humans and non-humans who live during it and for those who come after.
Yeah. Now the rulers, they measure the indifference. Can you live with this history blistering like the PD opal images?
The eighth premise of the book. The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of the economic system. I've just made it impossible for me to hold any public office. Another way to put the eighth premise is, any economic or social system that doesn't benefit the natural communities on which it is based is unsustainable, immoral, and really stupid. Sustainability, morality, and intelligence, as well as justice, requires the dismantling of any such economic or social system, or at the very least disallowing it from damaging your land base.
Listen close up to the hum of the land. Wheat belts kinda thirsty for some sustenance and the indelible scars from years of pastoralist hands. I can't understand the land master the man.
The ninth premise of the book is, although there will clearly someday be far fewer humans than there are at present, there are many ways this reduction in population could occur. Some of those ways would be characterized by extreme violence, nuclear Armageddon, for example, and others would be characterized by less violence. The 10th premise of the book is that the culture as a whole and most of its members are insane.
Now, history is a shame to me, but I still got faith in humanity. Come and swap back all the wrongs for rights. I let the people walk free every day and night.
The 11th premise of the book is that from the beginning, this culture has been a culture of occupation. And the government has been a government of occupation. What does a government of occupation do? It moves in, it facilitates the extraction of resources, and it doesn't particularly care about communities.
Got no heart, I got no right. And if you decide to fight, please know that we can fight together.
So, next premise. There are no rich people in the world, and there are no poor people. There's people. The rich may have lots of pieces of paper that many pretend are worth something, and the poor may not. The rich claim they own land, and the poor are often denied the right to make the same claim. A primary purpose of the police is to enforce the delusions of those with lots of pieces of paper. Those without the papers generally buy into these delusions almost as quickly and completely as those with. These delusions carry with them extreme consequences in the real world.
I don't know where to stand. Upon the mountain, down in the sand.
The 13th premise of the book. Those in power rule by force. And the sooner we break ourselves of the illusions to the contrary, the sooner we can at least begin to make reasonable decisions about whether, when, and how we're going to resist. I'm jumping to the 15th premise just because I love this premise so much. I want to mention this one. Love doesn't imply pacifism.
Music in those clips came from groups playing to save the ancient Lake Cowell in Australia. For more information, connect with scan.org. It's a bit rude to grab bits from a speech lasting an hour and a half, but I hope it's useful, even to those who disagree. Of course, the speech, and especially the book's endgame, go into examples and explanations of each of his points. Here are more rough and ready clips from Derek Jensen.
That the only measure by which we will be judged will be the state in which we leave the natural world. People who come after, the human people who come after, are not going to care about whether we voted or did not. They're not going to care about whether we signed petitions or we didn't sign petitions. They're not going to care about whether we were violent or nonviolent. They're going to not care whether we took down dams or didn't take down dams. They're not going to care about whether we designed groovy eco-villages or whether we came up with this wonderful eco-socialist utopia with free love all around, what they're going to care about is whether they can drink the water and whether they can eat the food and whether they have a land to live on. And I'm really clear on what I want, at least, and I can't speak for anyone else here or anywhere else, but I know what I want, which is that I want to live in a world that has more wild salmon in it every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has more migratory songbirds every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has less dioxin every mother's breast milk every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has more large fish in the center of the oceans every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that's not being dismantled. And I will do whatever it takes to get there. I will do whatever it takes. I would say that the messiness, the nastiness of the crash will come almost exclusively by those whose lifestyles are destroying the planet, attempting to maintain that lifestyle. I know about Pedro Martinez's toe, but I can't name 10 species of edible plants and fungi who live right outside my own home. I find that one of the reasons we don't defend the places we live is because we don't live there. You know, we live with Brad and Angelina and with Pedro and with Barry, and I'm really hoping that he's able to play this year. I mean, he's so close to the record. Oh, so close. It's weird. I know how to navigate Word for Windows much better than I know how to navigate the game trails right outside my home. That's crazy. I mean, that's really crazy. We can fantasize whatever we want, but the truth is there's only one level of technology that's sustainable, and that's the Stone Age. And we will be there again someday, and the only question will be what's left of the world when we get there. If you're civilized, you know, your hands are bloody already. You're living on stolen land. You're living on land, I'm living too, on stolen land. I'm not attacking anybody here on this. And everything within this culture, every action within an industrial economy is harmful. And what do you do with the knowledge that if you don't act, things are going to get worse and worse and worse, and if you do act, it's going to, at the very least, inconvenience a lot of people and probably kill a lot of people. What do you do with that? It's a classic double bind. You know, double bind is where if you choose option one, you lose. If you choose option two, you lose, and you can't withdraw. What do we do? And I was stuck on that for a long time because I didn't want to just sort of dance around that question, and then I finally got the answer. And is Becky Tarbottin here? Hey, she actually was the one who came up with the answer, which I now have just stolen and use everywhere. And the answer to that particular problem is, if you've gotten this far in this book, or if you're simply anything other than entirely insensate, we probably agree that civilization is going to crash, whether or not we help bring it about. If you don't agree with this, we probably don't have much to say to each other. We probably also agree that the crash will be messy. We agree further that since industrial civilization is systematically dismantling the ecological infrastructure of the planet, the sooner civilization comes down, whether or not we help it crash, the more life will remain afterwards to support both humans and non-humans. If you agree with this, and if you don't want to dirty your spirituality and conscience with the physical work of helping to bring down civilization, and if your primary concern really is for the well-being of those humans who will be alive during and immediately after the crash, then given, and I repeat this point to emphasize it, that civilization's going to come down anyway, you need to start preparing people for the crash. Instead of coming to my talks and attacking me for stating the obvious, go rip up asphalt and vacant parking lots to convert them to neighborhood gardens. Go teach people how to identify local edible plants, even in the city, especially in the city, so these people won't starve when the proverbial shit hits the fan, they can no longer head off to Albertsons for groceries. Set up committees to eliminate or, if appropriate, channel the additional violence that might break out. We need it all. We need people to take out dams. You know, there are 2 million dams in this country. There are 60,000 dams over 13 feet tall and 70,000 dams over 6.5 feet tall. If we took out one dam a day, it would take us 200 years to take out all the dams. That's if we only do one a day. Let's roll up our sleeves. We need people to take out dams, and we need people to knock out electrical infrastructures. We need people to protest and to chain themselves to trees. We also need people working to ensure that as many people as possible are equipped to deal with the fallout when the collapse comes.
You say, I must renounce nonviolence because it hasn't worked. Did those burned buildings stop construction? Did bombs help something? When did violence ever solve anything? Communism fell in Eastern Europe not from armed rebellions, but by millions of brave people standing in the streets with candles. I said we needed to listen to all voices. Here is the way authorities describe these eco-warriors. It's taken from the CBS 60 Minutes program.
When they first emerged in the mid-1990s, the environmental extremists calling themselves the Earth Liberation Front announced they were the burning rage of a dying planet. Ever since, the ELF, along with its sister group, the Animal Liberation Front, has been burning everything from research labs to housing developments. In the last decade, these so-called eco-terrorists have been responsible for more than $100 million in damages, and their tactics are beginning to escalate. Some splinter groups have set off homemade bombs and threatened to kill people. As we reported last November, things have gotten so bad, the FBI now considers them the country's biggest domestic terrorist threat. John Lewis, the Deputy Assistant Director for Counterterrorism at the FBI, is the man charged with stamping out eco-terrorism in the United States.
How many attacks are we talking about here?
Well, we're aware of over 1,000.
Lewis says the reason these groups are considered such a threat is because they've caused over $100 million worth of damage nationwide. And he says there are more than 150 investigations of eco-terrorist crimes underway. He admits they're not in the same league as Al-Qaeda, but he says they're ratcheting up their actions and turning up the rhetoric.
There have been multiple statements made regarding assassination and or killing of individuals involved in, for instance, biomedical research and that kind of thing.
Since our report first aired last fall, the FBI announced the arrests of 11 people, saying they were part of a criminal group that called themselves the Family. They're accused of committing over a dozen arsons and other acts of sabotage nationwide, including those fires on top of Vail Mountain.
Still, Jensen is right to say we are losing the battle for nature. The salmon, the rainforests, the birds, the great ocean life, plants and frogs are disappearing under the weight of the consumer economy. And as Jensen eloquently expresses, all of us have to deal with that, one way or another, with the pressing despair this knowledge brings us. Now let's review the links and resources hovering around Derek Jensen. Incidentally, Derek is spelt D-E-R-R-I-C-K and then J-E-N-S-E-N. His website is simply derekjensen.org. There you can read samples of his work and buy a number of his books. Some are co-authored by George Drafan, such as Welcome to the Machine. Drafan's website is www.endgame.org. Jensen's early bestseller was Listening to the Land, published in the mid-1990s when he was still quite young. According to his website, this is, quote, a collection of interviews with environmentalists, feminists, theologians, philosophers, and Indians centering around the question, if the destruction of the natural world isn't making us happy, why are we doing it? I also noted his 2003 book, Strangely Like War, The Global Assault on Forests, with a foreword by Vandan Shiva. It's part of his roots, the struggle against big forest companies in the Pacific Northwest. His heroes, among books Jensen recommends, are technology critic Lewis Mumford, native activist Ward Churchill, and Stanley Diamond, author of In Search of the Primitive, A Critique of Civilization. Also, the works of anarchist John Zerzan, such as Against Civilization, and the older standard, Anatomy of Human Destructiveness by psychologist Eric Fromm. In addition to his writing, Jensen has worked to help prisoners, the victims of this civilization, and learn from native people near his home in Northern California. There's also a link to another anti-civilization activist, Eric McBay, who mixes post-crash survival skills with ways to encourage the coming industrial collapse. At McBay's website, www.inthewake.org, you'll even find an online guide for survival called Tools for Grid Crash. So there you go, resources for those who have given up on the wonders and horrors of modern life, those who want to kick it over, or at least tip the system, almost like tipping over cows while they sleep, standing up. A book or radio review doesn't always agree with the author. At Radio EcoShock, we still believe in green, peace, the green and the peace together, protesting the destruction of nature in nonviolent ways. That's it from me, Alex Smith, from www.ecoshock.org. Sign up for our free podcast or tune in for All Environment Radio 24/7. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org. There's no copyright on this work. Distribute or rebroadcast as you will.
Welcome to War of the Trees on WSQT Guerrilla Radio, where Earth comes first and corporate profits come last. To the FBI, if you're an elf, you're a terrorist. They don't distinguish between heroes who fight for our Earth, murderers who bomb abortion clinics, and jihadis who take down office buildings full of thousands of people. Well, after they do distinguish, abortion clinic bombers typically serve about 5 years. Bombing an abortion clinic doesn't get you 20 years for being a so-called terrorist. The reason for that is obvious. The people who run the criminal injustice system in George Bush don't approve of abortion, so they probably don't care when a clinic gets bombed. But they sure do care about the auto industry and the SUV dealers.